big few weeks it's been on a journey through Stockache and Waterman. Matthew Demby, have you recovered from our two-part Better the Devil You Know special?
Barely, but what a great experience that was. The downloads were off the charts. Those two episodes were very easily our fastest downloaded episodes ever. People absolutely love Better the Devil You Know. It's such a special song for so many Kylie fans. And a big thank you to those of you who wrote us some lovely messages. I was particularly touched by some of the feedback I got about my little speech about Kylie and her relationship with her gay fans. We do very much appreciate you sharing your feelings about those episodes.
And we do very much like when you do a little speech, Matthew. Now, it was also nice to catch up with some of our subscribers for a debrief to talk through all the revelations from those two episodes. It was great to connect with those subscribers who really do keep this show in production. To support A Journey Through Saw, head to chartbeats.com.au/saw, and you can gain access to what I think is fair to say is a treasure trove of bonus content. But now the journey continues, doesn't it, Matt?
Yeah, we're all about uncovering the stories here on this podcast, and there are plenty more great ones to come, even if some of the songs aren't as big as Better the Devil You Know.
And we're going to kick off this episode with a tale that hasn't fully been told until now. The story of sisters Romy and Jazz, who worked with Stockache and Waterman on the single One Love, One World. That was One Love, One World by Romy and Jazz, which charted in June 1990, peaking at number 98 in the UK. But despite that disappointing chart performance, the track is something of a fan favourite. I've had quite a lot of people tell me how much they like it, and there's plenty of people pretty excited to hear from Romy and Jazz on the show.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. We're now moving into a phase where some of the tracks Saw were releasing weren't making much of a dent in the wider pop consciousness, and this is one of them. I don't remember hearing this at the time. By mid-1990, I was probably off somewhere wearing a hoodie, tending to my floppy hair and listening to the Stone Roses. Well, I was no longer closely following every Saw release anyway.
Picks or it didn't happen. Okay, well, let's dive in. Along with their older brother Ravi, Romy and Jazz got into music from a really early age. All types of music, both from their Punjabi background and the top 40 hits of the day in Britain. And that merging of influences would continue as they progressed towards a career in music.
Yeah, after initially performing at family and local events as a trio, Ravi eventually took on a more behind-the-scenes role, working on the songwriting and music with his sisters, who took the spotlight as a duo.
Romy is the younger sister by almost exactly 1 year, and Jazz drew some comparisons to Mel and Kim, and like that duo, they forged new ground in UK music. For Mel and Kim, with Saw behind them, it was house music that they'd taken mainstream, whereas Romy and Jazz blended traditional Bangra sounds with pop. But could they break through in the same way? Romy and Jazz are going to tell us now about taking their first steps into music and the environment in which they found themselves. And we're going to hear from Romy first.
We've always embraced global music. So that was something right from the start, maybe because we were, you know, being Indian and being here in England, listening to all the different types of music and all the different beats. That was already inbred in us. So we started very young, really, just always genuinely interested in music. It wasn't like one day we woke up and thought, oh, we want to be pop stars or we want to do music. Yeah. It was, you know, it was for a pure enjoyment and just the love of music. And I loved also dancing as well. I joined. It was quite controversial at the time, being 16. I said to my parents that I wanted to, you know, go to performing arts of dance school. There weren't anyone, there was no Asian face, Asian young woman doing anything like that then. So we were kind of like trying to push the boundaries with our parents as well, between the cultures. Jazz was actually doing a journalism course, weren't you, Jazz? And you got, we did a demo called So Alone.
Yeah.
And you got us on the local GWR radio.
Yeah, at the time, yeah.
And we were just like, just normal, humble background. To go from where we were to what we achieved, you know, it is something to be proud of. You know, it wasn't just a pop thing for us. For us, it was just also breaking boundaries and being a voice for young people. That was quite different at that time. We did face a lot of challenges.
What were your role models from your culture? Were there people in the public eye that you could identify with?
So if I'm honest with you, can I just say, you know, like back when we were growing up, it was not cool to be Asian. There was nobody there that represented, in my view. We did have other programs. We had journalists. We had, BBC were doing the BBC Asian Network. So things were starting to come out, you know, where you're not just sort of pigeonholed and you're just not an Indian face dressed in a sari. We were sort of growing up at a time where, you know, the second generation were trying to push through and, you know, fuse both cultures. When we were doing music, they used to have day gigs. The nightclubs used to open in the daytime and they used to have daytime bangra gigs, you know. And so it gave an opportunity for all these young children that were probably trying to be very westernized, but also trying to balance the culture side of things and please their parents. You and I, Jazz, we didn't actually do many of those gigs. We didn't attend as many. We performed at them.
No, we didn't. And I think it's fair to say as well, also their music industry as well is very male dominated. It's certainly from the Asian scene. So there wasn't hardly any Asian women, young girls that wanted to kind of stand up and have a voice and kind of, you know, have the opportunity to be able to sing and perform, because that was unheard of. You know, Asian women back then were told that you're not allowed to go out, you're not allowed to cut your hair, you have to dress in a certain style, etc. But we were two young girls. We were born in Kenya, but we pretty much were raised, you know, in England. And we really had two cultures, and we really, really just wanted to get out there and just say, look, we really need to give Asian, other Asian women, and show them you can do whatever you want in life. You know, you don't have to be restrained.
You don't have to conform.
Yeah, you don't have to conform. But also, we loved our culture. We embraced our culture. We loved who we were and our identities and our roots. And we just wanted to fuse those things together and also make our Asian community feel very, very proud about what we were trying to achieve.
Right. I really admire their guts in pushing back on everyone's expectations, especially when British Asians weren't so visible in the UK music scene at the time. That would obviously start to change a bit as the 90s rolled on. There's a lot of courage and determination involved in putting yourself out there in the music world, and these two obviously had what it took to do that.
They sure did, but demos and ambition are all well and good. Sometimes, though, you just need a lucky break. And that's what Romy and Jazz got when they attended one of those day club events they talked about. Let's hear from Jazz about how being in the right place at the right time and a bit of pluck on her part led to the sisters connecting with independent label Arishma Records and recording this remake of a Motown classic.
We were about 21, 22, I think, at the time. And there was a gig going on at a leisure centre where we used to live in Swindon. And it was an Asian band that were playing. So we went along and went to go and see them perform. And it was half time. And I kind of looked at Romy and Ravi and said, you know what? And at that point, we had done a couple of demos just, you know, on a 24-track recording studio. And we really now wanted to try and get the connections and make contacts in the music industry. So I kind of looked at Remy and Ravi and I said, you know what, I think I might just go to that sound engineer and just say, has he got any contacts in the music industry? And I said, Remy, do you want to come with me? And she said, no, I'll tell you what, you go. And I was always kind of quite bolshy. And
I was quite shy.
And I've kind of my journalism hat on. I said, right, I'm going to go speak to him. So I said, excuse me. I said, my name's Jazz. He said, yeah. And I said, I'm a singer, and I was just wondering, I've got a couple of demos, and I was just wondering if you can, you know, give us any kind of contact in the music industry. And he said, looked at me, he said, your name's Jazz. I said, yeah, and I'm here with my sister. She sings too. He said, what, you both sing? And he said, you know what? He said, I'm just going to introduce myself. I'm Deepak Gazanji. I'm not a sound engineer. I'm actually a record producer and obviously also engineer in the production for today's concert. He said, I'm about to put an advert in NME, which was a massive musical magazine back then. Now, I'm looking for a new duo act as part of my crossover music. And he said, here's my card. Can you come in next week for an audition? And then we'll take it from there. And let's just hear what you're all about. So all three of us went in. Ravi bought his guitar. Ravi played the guitar. Romy sang. We sang together. And I think they just from that moment, they got a sense of our personalities, and they already had a track in mind that they wanted to move on as a next project. And of course, that was the reach out by the Four Tops, the cover version. but they really wanted that kind of Bangra sound. And really, that's how Romeo and Jazz formed, and that's how that record came about.
She had the courage. I've got to say, she had the courage to do it because I did. I was like, no, they're not going to be interested. And she's like, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, you can go for it.
Within recording that particular song, and within, like, I think about 5-6 weeks later, it was nailed. We were performing our very first gig at the Empire Ballrooms in London. It went extremely, extremely well. It was really, really good. It was buzzing.
We were introduced as the new crossover act, and the music was not traditional. It was crossed over. So, credit to Deepak Khazanji, who was trying to produce something with electronic sounds and using the latest equipment, basically infusing the two. He did a really good job there. Classic four tops. People didn't expect that. They expect you to sing an Indian song coming on stage. And here we were singing the four tops. And it just exploded from there. Everybody was talking about it. And, you know, we started getting interest from all the sort of music pundits out there. We weren't expecting it to go like a roller coaster, which it did.
I mean, the song itself, obviously, Reach Out, classic song. And I really like the direction that they were trying to mix the Bhangra with the pop element.
I believe Pete Ware was also involved. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
he was.
That's right. He was the partner. He was a really good influence as well, to be fair. He did a lot of the musical arrangement, the keyboards.
Instruments, arrangements. He engineered it as well, didn't he? Yeah.
I think the Irishma Records, they're not here to speak. My interpretation is that they were very much like following at that time PWL was buzzing and coming up. And they were thinking, well, why can't we do that? Why can't we be the next PWL and these girls do something along the same path? And the music, the way it was going, was very similar to what they were trying to do with us.
Now, around the same time as your version of Reach Out, PWL actually remixed the Four Tops version. Do you have any memory of that?
You know what? I can't. I don't have any memory of that. I think we were so into our zone with Reach Out. Our version certainly created a lot of buzz. You know, when we did the Empire Ballrooms, we were on BBC Radio 1. We were on the cover of the Times magazines, the Telegraph. It just created a lot of buzz. So it's because it was so different.
From our perspective, we were unaware of it. There might have been something with the Pete Ware connection and that type of stuff going on from a higher end. I don't know. We didn't sit down and discuss with them, this is the song we're going to be doing. Do you want to choose a Motown track? We were presented with the Motown track Reach Out at the time. You know, so we didn't really have a say in that. But we just spoke about how we're going to sing it, what it will be. We had some creative control, but not a lot.
Was Irishma only that one single?
Well, basically, we did the vocals for Reach Out, and then Irishma came to our house to talk about the contract, and we'd recorded it. We did the live version of everything. We did our first PO, and then it was a very retrospective looking at the contracts and signing things, because obviously then they had to release it. But they wanted to sign us up as session singers, and we weren't very happy with that because Romeo and Jazz have been singing since young.
So we kind of realised then, hang on a minute.
You know, we're not just session singers. You know, we should have our right to be able to earn royalties in the same way that as any other artist should be able to. So it was that, unfortunately, which broke our relationship with Irishma Records.
The release of Reach Out may not have worked out how Romeo and Jazz had hoped, but with their first record in stores, more doors were about to open for them. I hadn't heard their version of Reach Out until I researched this episode, but I think the 12-inch Bhangra mix is really enjoyable. The song works really well with that Bhangra infusion, and there's even a little bit of ABBA influence there in the production.
Yeah, I think remaking Reach Out in this style was a really good idea. When I first heard it, I thought, gee, it sounds like something from PWL. Then when I saw Pete Ware was behind it, it all made sense. It definitely has its roots in those early tracks that he did while still working with Mike and Matt. It was possibly a little dated in terms of that high energy component for 1988, and I maybe would have sped it up a little, but with the right support, this could have been a hit because the Bhangra element was something new. And from what I can determine, it did beat the Four Tops remix into the shops by a month or two.
Right. Well, Romy and Jazz were determined to remain true to their dream of being performers in their own right. Therefore, an offer of session work wasn't going to cut it for them. So they set out in pursuit of a new deal, which led them to Chrysalis Records, which was one of a few labels interested in the duo following the buzz created by Reach Out.
And on Chrysalis, before One Love, One World, Romy and Jazz released two singles. People in the House, which was co-written and co-produced by Tambi Fernando, a name we've heard on the podcast before. That was from September 1988. And Love Crime, a track they co-wrote with producer Dave James, released almost a year later in August 1989. Let's hear those two tracks now. People in the House.
Now let's hear from the ladies themselves about the start of their journey with Chrysalis.
We had a really good A&R guy with Pete Robinson.
Pete Robinson, yeah.
He was really lovely. He was really supportive. He was supportive of trying to fuse the Bangred, the Asian sound, and trying to break two Asian girls into the sort of mainstream music industry. That I think that was something that we all wanted to do. We even got ourselves a publishing deal through Chrysalis as well. So, you know, we were really happy there, to be fair.
Reach Out was the single that made them stand up and go, wow, this is something completely different. And I think they wanted to try that journey a little bit more to see where that would take them. You have to remember that period in time, Bhangra music was very underground. It was very much kept in the Asian scene and in the Asian community, but it was never crossed over. Their vision was, let's just see where that goes. Let's do a couple more songs to see where that takes the sisters. They teamed us up with Roald McCarney of FJR Studios and Tambi Fernandez, who was Pepsi and Shirley fame. So we worked with them on our next single, which was People in the House. It is really the next stage of what Romy and Jazz was, more popular.
There was a lot of tablas in that. Very talented tabla player, Talvin Singh, who's worked with some amazing artists. And his technical percussion was amazing. So we've got a lot of that going through our song, Put People in the House. No disrespect to the industry, what they were trying to do with us. But I think, you know, even they didn't know what to do with us in a funny way, because a traditional Bhangra music is actually a massive drum. It's like a really big drum, and you play it with two like sticks. And that beat, it's in the Reach Out beat, basically. That's actually Bhangra. The tablas complement it, but it's actually just that drum that is the Bhangra sound and a specific beat. So I think sometimes as we were doing the music thing, I think we were almost going away from Bhangra, and it was almost like the tabla sound. People think, oh, that's Bhangra, but it wasn't. So I think, you know, obviously we didn't have enough control at that stage to say where it should be going.
They just allowed us to experiment vocally. So, you know, again, Romy would mix her Indian kind of wailing kind of sounds into the commercial element, which was, again, so different and fresh. And I think those are the kind of things that were really kind of gelled the songs together. But again, I don't know whether the public were ready to hear all of that.
Let's move on to Love Crime. It sounds like it could have been a hit. What kind of reaction were you getting, first of all, from the Asian community to what you were doing musically?
I think it was 50-50, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
You could see that when we were touring the song.
I think the young men, we came across some resistance, if you like, not from necessarily the older generation, but actually, believe it or not, would be from the younger men in the audience. It's almost like they were like not happy about seeing females up on stage. Sometimes we would come across that, which really surprised us. You'd expect it from the elder generation, but not from the younger youth. That was a bit tough. And then most of the time we did get very positive reaction. Most of the time people were like really interested, because a lot of people were trying to break away. And like I said, you know, it was such a difficult time. If you were those day gigs, that's what they were all about. They were all about young male and female ladies and midgets going out there and just enjoying themselves, being themselves. And that's what we wanted for them as well, basically.
And I think the other thing you have to remember, Gavin, is that during that period, there wasn't a specific platform where we could take our music. So unless you were playlisted on Radio 1, unless you were seen on BBC TV, and unless you were, you know, in the charts, how would people get to hear your song? So when we did our tour with every song that we did, The People in the House, Love Crime, we always did a 6-week tour of doing all of the nightclubs, the daytime clubs with every song that we did, 6 weeks ahead of the release date, and then bang, it would come out. But during that period, that would be the only FaceTime that we got with our audience. So you've got to imagine, in those clubs that we were doing, it was predominantly Western people, English people, not many Asian people in that environment. If there were, they were only the men, because Asian women weren't allowed to go out to nightclubs, you know, or they were restricted. So, and the only place that they were allowed to go out were these day banger gigs. So we did obviously the big festivals, and we did have a lot of following there. And that was a chance to really reach out to the Asian community, was through those Asian festivals. So I would say it's 50-50. I think people, the girls, were really rooting for us because they could see what we were trying to achieve, and they really wanted us to kind of be their voices and kind of be their role models. But we did get that resistance, and it's just a shame that we just didn't get that high level media presence, because if we did, I think it would have just, you know, allowed us to kind of continue our journey a bit further.
I look back at it now and I think it was the timing wasn't right for us. The audience went ready to hear that fusion, sadly, and that came even now. We look at the industry today, who's there today doing what we were trying to do? Who's actually broken? There have been artists that have tried, and it still hasn't happened in a big way, apart from Jay Sean obviously has done it as a male, but what female person has been up there? For young women, you know.
Despite their first two singles on Chrysalis not having crossed over, the label wasn't ready to give up on Romy and Jazz. It seems like there was enough of an underground buzz around the duo to give it one more shot.
And who better to turn to than Stock Aitken Waterman, who had such a solid history of crossover pop success and who once again seemed to be paying more attention to what was happening in the club and R&B scenes. It seems like both parties were open to evolving at this point, so the match had a lot going for it.
It was also a pretty good idea for Stock Aitken Waterman to work with an act like Romy and Jazz, I think. With Kekko having failed and Sonia and Big Fun coming to the tail end of their album cycles, they needed new blood in the Hit Factory. And Romy and Jazz offered Saw the potential to really do something new, which, as we've discussed previously, was what was needed in 1990.
The track that Saw came up with for Romy and Jazz took inspiration from the contemporary dance floor, just like their recent big hits with Lonnie Gordon and Kylie Minogue had done. And the boys seemed to take particular inspiration from this number.
Yes, UK Top 10 hit Don't Miss the Party Line by Belgian dance act Business, which featured future 2 Unlimited mastermind Jean-Paul Da Costa among its members. And the influence of that track can clearly be heard in One Love, One World. Take a listen.
Sampling was very much the flavour of the moment in 1990, and a notable ingredient that sets this record apart from old-school 80s Saw was the very prominent use of sampled speech clips from Martin Luther King.
This really was unlike anything else Stock Aitken Waterman had done. It was also the clubbiest thing they'd done probably since Showing Out, and the lyrics weren't the usual fare at all.
Yeah, this one was clear evidence that Saw had woken up and smelt the coffee as their old formula struggled against the tide of change in 1990. Not only is it a notable musical update, but the lyrics stray very far from the standard themes we'd become so used to. Let's hear from the talent now about the experience of working with Saw and how the song came together.
So I think Pete Robinson approached Pete Waterman, and I think Pete Waterman had already kind of seen where we were going with some of the other tracks. And I think those two guys just picked up the phone and had a chat with each other. And then it was the early part of January 1990 that we got a call to say that PWL would like to have a meeting. And that's when we met with Pete Waterman. And that really was just about for him to understand who we were, what we wanted, our personalities, and just kind of get to know us as people, really. From there, I think it was about 2 weeks later or something, we got the phone call to say that they definitely want to work with us. But I think Pete Waterman, or PWL certainly, they definitely didn't want to do anything Bangra. It was definitely going to be under their umbrella, their formula, their sound.
And what did you make of Pete Waterman?
Pete Waterman, lovely guy.
Yeah, really warm.
Oh my God, such genuine guy, honestly, really, really. He was really into his cars. He was such a down-to-earth guy, and he really believed in Romeo and Jazz, really did.
Yeah, I must admit, out of the three of them, he was always very supportive, great guy to talk to. They're all three of them amazing, talented producers. They themselves had a lot of resistance, and, you know, because they were dominating the charts and they were able to just produce these tracks, and they were absolutely just blinding. And so for us to be working, when we heard that we had a chance to work with PWL, we were like, absolutely, we would love to do that. We'd be an honour.
So how did One Love, One World come together?
We were invited to the studio. They have a format, basically. You go in on a Monday, you meet up with them, and you literally come back the next day and they've written a song for you.
That's how quick it was.
And I always remember walking in down the cobbled streets, opening that big front door, sitting in reception, waiting to go in and meet with the guys, really, Mike and Matt. And we went in with a couple of our own demos, just to kind of give them a sense of our kind of a sound and our creativity. So they did play a couple of our demos, and they sat back like this, listening to them. They said, yeah, I really like that. It's quite catchy, isn't it? It's quite catchy. I think they just wanted to understand us as people. And I think whatever it was that we said during that kind of meeting, they were able to take away what they wanted to be able to think about how they were going to write this song. And then they just said to us, can you come back in tomorrow? And we'll have a song ready for you. So we didn't know at that point what it's going to sound like, what direction it was going to be in or anything like that. The first time we heard it was when you kind of walk into the booth and it's like, this is the drum pattern, this is the bass line, and this is kind of the basic chords, and this is the chorus. And you kind of had a board which said One Love. I remember going in with Romy and just singing the choruses. And then Romy had her turn to kind of do all of the lead vocals, and us not really knowing what it was going to sound like.
The track was quite empty. It was hard for me to just think, oh, well, I couldn't really do much with it vocally. I felt they hadn't done all the production on it. It was literally probably about 3-4 instruments. I do remember that it being very basic. And then melodically, they would just say how they thought it should go. And then I would sort of hopefully think I got it right. So it was enjoyable, but it was quick. Probably the fastest one we've ever done compared to the other producers that we work with.
I think that's where the experience was quite different, because some of the other songs we recorded, we'd spend days in a recording studio. With Saw, I couldn't believe it was just a whirlwind. You walked in, you just did the song and you were out. And I remember specifically writing in my diary, because I used to keep a diary back then, and writing something like, wow, we've just done our song. I think it's called One Love. It happened so quick, or something like that.
And other than that, what were Mike and Matt like? How did you find them in the brief time you had in the studio?
Polite, friendly, but to the point. They didn't want to waste time. They were very, very focused on what they had to do. And also, I was a little bit nervous because, like Jazz said, that, you know, you didn't normally have this when we met with producers and staff. It was really much a lot more relaxed, and we would do the song over a couple of days. They didn't say you have to sing it in, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours or anything, or whatever, but you certainly got that feel from them that this is business. Bosh, 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 bosh. Thank you very much.
You didn't have any creative control, put it that way. You didn't have any creative control. And that was something that we were kind of used to doing with our previous songs.
You have to totally trust them.
We totally trusted them. I mean, at that point, they'd had hit after hit after hit. Why wouldn't you trust them? You just had to go with the flow and respect that they were who they were, which we did. And we knew that they would deliver, you know, in terms of the song and the sound. And it was very refreshing to hear it back when it was mastered. I have a vision, I have a dream that
What did you think of the lyrics of the song?
I loved it. I really liked it, Gavin. We were absolutely so happy with the lyrics because we were growing up ourselves, sometimes with confrontation. Even today, those words, they can work today with all the wars that are going on, with what's happening with Russia. And I'm really proud. I was kind of honoured that we didn't do a love track. And like, okay, here's the two girls, do a pop track. They did push it a little bit. And I don't know. I think that most of their artists at the time were all singing about love. So for us to be doing that track with them, I thought it was really refreshing. And I commend them on that. And I'm proud that they were words that meant something. And we were very passionate about it.
Well, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because, yeah, I mean, Stock Aitken Waterman weren't known for songs that made that kind of statement. I guess it was based on meeting you two that they went, actually.
Yeah, maybe we're not going to come. We didn't have boyfriends. We weren't your typical girls that were like, you know, I guess we probably talk a lot about our real experiences.
Just trying to think back to what made them think that they wanted to do that for us. You know, what gave them that kind of guidance. And I think it's probably the conversations that we've had in that first meeting with them about some of our cultural challenges and things like that. And I think from what they got from that conversation, they were able to write a song around us trying to bring down barriers and how then that would resonate from a universal perspective. The lyrics are, you know, really, really strong.
When we got it played back to us, I almost sat back and I was like, gosh, was that the song that I sang in the studio? Because it sounds, obviously, by the time they then fill it, then they drop the Martin Luther King bit in there. And I was like, whoa, that's really powerful.
And Jazz, what did you think of the finished track?
I thought it was very dancey. You know, I was kind of excited to see how we would work our dance routines around something like that. I love the fact that it had such a presence with the Martin Luther King. It was a moment in time that I think everyone is so familiar with that quote. And to bring that into a song, I thought was really, really special and very, very clever. And I just think the whole song just has some real meaning behind it. It had real strength. And I think it would have connected with lots of different people, different parts of the world. And I think had that broke, I think it would have done extremely well. I was very pleased with the final mix, yeah.
Not only the lyrics, the sound was really different for Stock Aitken Waterman. Did you feel like you were breaking new ground with Saw?
It was very fresh and very different. If you listen back to One Love, One World, it is different to everything else that they were doing at the time. And I think they also, and I specifically remember Peter Robinson saying to us, you know, they want to do like a soul-to-soul kind of era kind of music. They want to move into that. And I've got that as my note in one of my diaries. So that must have resonated with the part of a brief that they must have had between the two in terms of how they see us moving as next steps, really.
Yeah, this one's a real grower. And I can see the effort the boys put into taking a whole new tack with this. It doesn't have the ecstatic highs of a typical old school Saw song, but it does have a bunch of really strong moments. I enjoyed it. It's a well-constructed early 90s pop record.
Yeah, One Love, One World is very much a product of its time in some ways, but I also think it's a Saw track that has aged pretty well. And it does stand out from the more typical material coming out of the Hit Factory in the previous couple of years. Possibly because of that, it was never one of my favourite Saw songs at the time. I probably like it more now than I did in 1990, but it was good to see Saw being a bit more experimental. As for why it wasn't a hit, let's check in briefly with Matt Aitken for his thoughts.
I actually really like this record. Loud, this really works. I can't remember a lot about them. And they were both very good looking girls. Were they sisters? They were sisters, you know, and you thought, well, you've hit the jackpot here. Where did it all go wrong? Was the record any good? I think it was quite a good record, but I think it was probably more, I don't think it was quite club and I don't think it was quite radio.
Fell between two stools.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I think we both hit the nail on the head there.
Right, well, maybe the Sugar hit wasn't immediate enough for those Saw fans used to the big pure pop focus of the last 2 years. And perhaps other record buyers who like the club and R&B sounds at the moment weren't willing to give it a chance because of what Saw had been most known for since around early 88. It's worth noting the producers aren't mentioned anywhere on the Smash Hits ad for this record, where not so long ago any association with Saw was trumpeted. Brand damage was a very real issue in clubland, that is, outside of the gay clubs, which at this point would very happily play Saw's new generation of dance floor bangers. bangers. But this track isn't a gay club banger, and the audience it was aiming at weren't so receptive, or maybe they didn't even get to hear it. If you aren't being championed anywhere in clubland, that leaves only radio.
But would radio have played One Love, One World, even if it did fit more neatly into a category? The other thing to bear in mind is something we're going to come across increasingly as this podcast continues, the backlash against Stock Aitken & Waterman. As much as Saw fans would have loved to have seen the good times on the UK chart continue into the 90s, it did get harder and harder for non-Kylie and non-Jason songs to cut through. And that was even the case with songs like this, and many of the ones that are still to come on the show, that were actually good tracks. With that in mind, let's go back to Romy and Jazz to reflect on the release of One Love, One World and what they did afterwards. Given what was happening, and you know, they were facing their own backlash, which you alluded to earlier, they weren't having as consistent the hits coming into 1990 as they had been in the 80s. There was a little bit of, oh, another Stock Aitken & Waterman track. Did you get the vibe that working with them, people were going, oh, wow, Stock Aitken & Waterman, or people were going, ugh, Stock Aitken & Waterman?
I think the latter.
The feedback that we got was people weren't saying, oh, Romy and Jazz, nah, don't like the song, don't like them. It was all what you said. It was like before they even saw us, before they even judged the track, before they even played that song, as soon as they saw PWL, it was like, nah, you know, especially on the radio side of things. So I think we got caught up in all of that, sadly. And it's a shame because those guys were really good. You know, they're really talented and they were fighting battles within themselves. You know, people were not respecting them because they were earning oodles and oodles of money. And that's what the music business was about, earning money. And they were doing a great job.
They were definitely dominating airwaves, that's for sure. I think by the time we came out with One Love, One World, I think the radio was kind of getting a bit like, oh, not another song. And they started like almost like embargoing them, like saying, no, we don't want any more Stock Aitken & Waterman songs. We're not going to play their songs anymore.
It was like a boycott at one point. That's it, felt right like that to us, in the caught in the middle of it all. And any songs that they were producing, there were people that had been in the business, had a lot more exposure than us. So brand new acts coming through, especially two Indian girls with a Bhangra element in the background, that was pretty brave. It was going to be hard, I think, for that one track to do that for us. Was a real shame. It didn't quite break where it needed to.
Well, and it's a shame because it was new for Stock Aitken & Waterman. So it was new for you, but it was new for them as well. And I guess if people had listened to it, they might have gone, oh, okay, it's Stock Aitken & Waterman, but not as we know them.
True. But again, like you said, we did the Hitman Roadshow. That was a good laugh, wasn't it, Jazz?
No, I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, talk to me about the roadshow.
Well, we used to love that because also, like you said, we really got to know Pete Waterman on those roadshows and going around. We had Sonia on the bus. We had Big Fun.
Lonnie Gordon.
Kako was on there. We had a blast. I mean, it was great. You know, you go out and you all together as one big family. You go out, you all had a routine. We all did our routine. We all supported each other. Everybody was there. It was like a big family.
Pete Waterman kind of said to us, whenever I do a roadshow like this, I always choose one act to come on and do a finale, like, you know, an encore. So, you know, I'll say Romy and Jazz and I'll bring you back out again because I want you to be on this tour for the next 6 weeks as the act I bring back out on stage. So he really believed in us and he was doing whatever he could to kind of push us. It was his way of really getting the youngsters engaged in our music. And at that point, we were getting a lot of the young teens that would follow us and write to us. We would get letters, we would get... It was just, you know, when you look back at it, it was absolutely amazing what we did.
So the song did break into the top 100, which I guess hadn't happened with any of the previous songs. So despite the uphill battle, despite the Stock Aitken & Waterman backlash, did you get the sense that momentum was building?
Well, I think the battle was just trying to get it airplayed. So I think for us, you know, you were out there performing it and you were performing it in the evening, but unless people could hear it in the daytime on radio, they wouldn't really connect the dots of how could people buy it. So even though it reached 98, and I think that was probably sheer through the tour, the touring and the PA element, I think that helped that get into the charts. But I think it didn't get any further because it wasn't playlisted, it wasn't played on radio. And I think that was the biggest blocker for us, I think.
And so what happened after that with Chrysalis, with you two?
Yeah, I think we got a bit disheartened, if I'm honest with you. And then we just got a phone call, obviously, from Chrysalis to kind of say, look, you know, girls, unfortunately, this hasn't worked. you know, it's a business at the end of the day for anyone. They're investing their money into you, they want some return. And if they're not getting that return, and then obviously you then have to then just say your goodbyes to each other. It was just the right time just to take a bit of a step back and have a bit of a breather. And
I personally was ready to sort of step back a little bit. I kind of lost myself, me personally, and not speaking for Jazz, but for me personally, I wanted to personally step back. Had we both wanted to still continue, we could have opened and knocked on other doors. We didn't even reapproach PWL, if I'm honest. You know, I don't know, it might have been a flat no. We might have had a conversation, you never know. So we never reapproached it. I think both Jazz and I just wanted to have a break from everything. And, you know, we never revisited it, did we, Jazz? So
no.
I was just grateful that I had this opportunity. But I didn't really, I think I just wanted to reflect on the type of music we were doing, what were we doing and where we were going, really. Before we did anything else, if we wanted to approach another record label. I think if we had done another track, we would have really known a little bit more about what would happen with our journey. It was a shame we hadn't done one more track with them. Had we gone to them a year before, a year and a half before, I think we would have been in a different place.
Mm.
Everything just sort of, the universe kind of caved in for them, for us. It just didn't position right for brand new artists. I mean, if you were already up there, like you, Kylie, Jason, they were already massive names.
Looking back on that era, not just the Stockacre and Waterman part, but those singles, looking back on that time as Rumi and Jazz, you must have fond memories of it. And, you know, despite it not getting where you wanted it to, it must still be something you're quite proud of.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Oh, 100%, Gavin. 100%. You know, we were really blessed.
Yeah.
You know, we were blessed to have that opportunity. Like Jazz said, didn't you? She had the courage to, you know, if anyone's listening out there, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get. And Jazz hadn't gone up to and spoken to that producer of the Deepika Kazanchi that day, those doors might not have opened for her. So, you know, you've got to believe in yourself and you've got to try and have the strength to do these things as young people. You know, we had an amazing time. It's a fantastic journey. I don't regret it one bit.
I think really for me on that as well, you know, we go down in history, you know, as the first two Asian girls to cross over with our earlier stuff with Reach Out, you know, and then being part of the Stock Aitken Waterman legacy and talking to you today, it just makes me feel so very proud because we had a dream and we did have a vision and we went for it.
That was a great interview, and it's taught me a lot about Romy and Jazz, who've always been a bit of a mystery to me. And let's remember, hits aren't always about what's the best record. Often, it's about the records that get heard. And I think if One Love had got a fair hearing, it probably would have charted pretty well.
Yeah, I was really fascinated to hear Romy and Jazz's story after having owned the 12-inch single of this track for decades. There was a great concept behind them musically, and it's a shame they couldn't break down those barriers. Since 1990, the sisters have moved on with their lives, but Jazz especially has continued to dabble with music. She even convinced Romy to reunite to record a remake of Groove Theory's Tell Me a few years ago. And Jazz also released a solo track called It's Our Love under the name Jazz in 2020. Let's take a listen. You can hear more about those songs from the ladies in the full interview in the bonus material. Thanks so much to both Romy and Jazz for sharing their story with us. Okay, from a single with a fresh act that was taking Soar in new directions, we come now to a pair of Hit Factory regulars who had a little help on a collaborative charity record.
Yeah, next up we've got another shift in tone for Soar. This time it's a charity record featuring two of the most prominent acts of the time, as well as one musician who wasn't ever featured in smash hits. Let's have a listen to You've Got a Friend by Sonia and Big Fun, and featuring Gary Barnacle on saxophone. Just look around, look around. I'll be there, I'll bet you can depend. I won't let you down, let you down. Don't you know that you've got a friend? That was You've Got a Friend, which charted in June of 1990, reaching number 14 in the UK and 12 in Ireland. It was the latest record in aid of the counselling service Childline. Back in 1988, Wet Wet Wet's Effort for the Cause, a cover of the Beatles with a little help from my friends, went to number one in the UK. But by 1990, the charity's coffers were running dry. So TV host Esther Ranson approached Sonia and Big Fun to help out when they made an appearance together at Fun Park Alton Towers. Here's Jason John from Big Fun and Sonia talking to Esther on the BBC show That's Life about why they got involved.
Can I ask you, Sonia, why you decided to make the record?
Because it's a brilliant cause, you know, and it means a lot to me to be involved. And anything, basically, that we can do to help, you know, we're all for it.
I should speak to all of you.
Yes, definitely.
I wondered whether you'd come across any children who've been through the kind of loneliness that makes them ring Childline, or whether you yourself have been through anything like that.
Well, we actually got some letters to the fan club, and it was from some children that needed some help. And personally, we wouldn't know how to advise them or give them that help. So what we did do was pass it on to Childline, which is just shows you. And we're all very lucky that we've never needed to have help like that. So just makes you realise what a cause that so many people have got to help to get this lines together.
Well, of course, the money from the record will go to Childline, and Childline needs it desperately.
Yes.
As you know.
Well, there's loads and loads of lines.
10,000 calls a day.
Unfortunately.
And about 1,000 can get through. And sometimes that's a child ringing 6-7 times at once trying to get through but can't get through.
In 1995, the cream of pop music, Danny Minogue, Peter Andre, Backstreet Boys, Boyzone, E17, it's a pretty good lineup, and a couple of names who have been long forgotten like Gemini, assembled as the Childliners for festive track The Gift of Christmas. I got it for the Motivate mix. Anyway, back to You've Got a Friend.
Yeah, while Sonia and Big Fun might have approached this record with the best of intentions, they received a notably frosty reception when they fronted up to promote it in the pages of Smash Hits. Whether it was charity record fatigue or the whiff of blood in the water from Saw's recent chart showings, the tone had definitely shifted at the magazine, which only a year prior had been riding high on the wave of Kylie and Jason mania. Big Fun were asked, "Do you worry that people will accuse you of trying to further your careers because the record will probably be a hit?" To which Jason from the band replied, "Well, I've got a top 10 album on my own. I've got hits all over Europe, so I'm not needing to go for publicity. I'm doing it for the cause." So that's just them putting a cynical view on a charity record. Other questions included pointed probing about what they all thought of the rise of Madchester, and this question: "Don't you think that Stock Aitken and Waterman Records are becoming unfashionable?" Jason replied, "I remember people saying that 5 years ago," added Sonia, and I'm not going to do this in a Liverpool accent. "They move with the times, you know. Pete can see what's happening, like." Then there was the final Smash Hits Kiss of Death with this question: "Do you dread going down the dumper? And what will you do if you fall into it? What other jobs would you like to do?" Ouch.
It's funny, Smash Hits is often written off by people who think it only ever asked questions like, "What's your favourite colour?" But having worked on the Australian version of the magazine a decade later, I can honestly say I never asked anything as mind-numbing as that. In fact, both the UK and Australian versions of the mag used to like holding pop stars to account when it was warranted, or asking more off-the-wall questions like, "What colour is Tuesday?" So this kind of grilling by Smash Hits of Sonia and Big Fun is to be expected, I think. The chart placings were starting to slide for the Hit Factory, and so the magazine rightfully wanted to get to the bottom of that. And as we'll discuss in the next episode, Smash Hits could really turn on a pop act when it decided to.
They sure could. Well, as for the track itself, while Wet 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 had gone with a cover version, Pete Waterman explained Saw's choice of song in his number one column. Quote, "We looked through the Beatles catalogue and the Carpenters as well, but poor old Paul McCartney has had so many of his songs used by causes, we felt it was time to give the bloke a break. We just felt there wasn't a song there that would work," unquote.
And it's not like they didn't try, because although the song that was released was an original track called You've Got a Friend, it would transpire that Sonia and Big Fun also recorded a version of the Carole King song of the same name, and that remake would surface on the reissue of A Pocket Full of Dreams in 2010. So why was that cover abandoned after it was recorded and the title announced, which meant Stock and Aitken had to come up with an original tune with the exact same name? Matt, what do you think?
Well, there's been some suggestion that the decision to do an original and not the cover might have come down to publishing considerations. But I think that kind of speculation is pretty damn dubious when Saw had a history of donating their services with charity covers of Let It Be and Do They Know It's Christmas.
Yeah, another perhaps more charitable theory I have is that with Sonia and Big Fun's next singles both being covers, End of the World and Hey There Lonely Girl respectively, someone somewhere might have thought back-to-back remakes was too much. That is, of course, assuming that those two songs were earmarked for release at this point, which, you know, they probably were. I asked Matt Aitken if he knew the reason for going from the cover version to the original, and, well, he couldn't actually recall recording the Carole King remake at all. Have a listen to this. Originally, you recorded the actual Carole King song, You've Got a Friend With Them.
Did we?
You did.
I have no recollection of doing the Carole King track. Absolutely none.
It wasn't released at the time, but it had since emerged on reissues.
Well, there's a version of it. Not bad. I like that. What's wrong with that?
I don't know. If it weren't a charity record, the obvious thing would have been, well, if we write something, we'll get the royalties. So I don't really know why you would have swapped.
Yeah, no idea.
So you have no recollection of recording that Carole King?
No.
Maybe you were on holidays.
No. That's definitely me. I mean, I don't know. Why would we call a new track the same as the old track? I can only imagine that some press had gone out or something. Did we do it very quickly?
Well, didn't you do everything very quickly? I think it must have been, like, the cover art must have been printed or something, or as you say, some promotion had gone out saying it's going to be You've Got a Friend. So I think you were probably stuck with the title.
Yeah, I mean, talk about being hemmed into a corner.
Because you don't need to get permission to do a cover, do you?
Yeah, if you don't change it radically.
Right, interesting. For my part, I think this succeeds pretty well as a song and as a production. I love the sax and the blending of vocals work surprisingly well in places. On that note, I'll add that Sonia's typically strong vocals show what Big Fun could have achieved had they hired a really powerful lead vocalist, with Mark perhaps providing some of his distinctive flavour behind that, because here his falsetto functions pretty well for me where it's used in that capacity.
Yeah, I don't mind You've Got a Friend. Regular listeners know what it means when I say that. And without my English pen friend, yes, her again, sending it to me, I doubt I would have rushed out and bought it. As a charity single for a cause like Childline, though, the mood was right. Someone made a comment on social media the other day about Sonia seeming too chirpy for a charity record. But, you know, the cause was relatively serious to raise money for a child helpline, but it was also designed to be hopeful. You've got a friend. There's someone there for you. This wasn't a record to raise funds for famine or a mass tragedy. So I feel like Sonia and Big Fun toned it down just the right amount. As for the song, listening to it again now, it has its charms, including the saxophone of Gary Barnacle, a man whose list of credits is truly astounding. He played on everything in the 80s and 90s. Seriously, look it up. Let's go back to Matt Aitken to hear a bit more about the inclusion of the saxophone and having Gary on the track.
He's done a lot of session work and he's worked on some difficult sessions. I think our sessions are sort of right up at the top of his difficult gigs to do. And we always seem to pitch our tracks that were right at the top of the tenor's range, the tenor sax's range. And he kept saying, "That's really a job for an alto." And we said, "No, we want tenor, we don't want alto." So he's always right at the top of the thing, which gives it that energy, yeah.
Not only did you make the vocalists strain for those high notes, but you made the saxophonist strain too.
We didn't start the song with the idea of accommodating a sax solo. That was just sort of later on in the thinking. I mean, it was styled on, the version that we ended up doing was styled on Junior Walker and the All-Stars. What Does It Take to Win Your Love? Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Which is why I think we got Gary involved.
Oh,
That was What Does It Take to Win Your Love by Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And I can certainly see the connection there with that sax.
It's quite notable to hear a saxophone on a Saw record, but although it was the first time Gary received a featured artist credit on the front cover, it wasn't his first session on a PWL release. He can be heard on Roadblock, he's a major part of that track, Whatever Makes Our Love Grow by Edwin Starr, and on Rick Astley's two PWL albums.
In terms of chart performance, a charity record of this nature was usually expected to place pretty highly in the top 10 around this point in time. The position it did get shows it didn't connect as expected. I put it down to the acts not resonating strongly enough with the audience, as well as Saw fatigue, because I think the song and the production are pretty solid. As some context, it's worth noting that the track was preceded by what would prove to be the final ever Hitman Roadshow tour. The headliners were Sonia and Big Fun. Kylie and Jason were off the roster, having jumped ship to do their own money-spinning tours. Despite the £5 tickets, the tour did not sell out, bringing more bad publicity and claims the Saw era was coming to an end. It was a sign that their stranglehold on teen pop culture was over, and it certainly showed that Sonia and Big Fun weren't the heirs apparent to Kylie and Jason mania. Pete Waterman was on the defensive when he wrote this in number one. I don't envisage another Hitman Roadshow this year, but we may do one next year. Everybody talks about Sonia and Big Fun not being successful, but they've both got albums in the top five. I'm not saying we haven't been quiet for this time of year, but we're entitled to be reserved after notching up 101 hits, unquote. Fact check, both albums got to number 7, and history would show that You've Got a Friend was Big Fun's last ever top 40 entry.
Hopes would certainly have been high for a top 10 placing for this track, a brand new song from two of Saw's key artists, especially since it was a charity release. But as we saw with Pat and Mick's Use It Up and Wear It Out, not even charity records were guaranteed to shoot right up the chart anymore. In our next episode, two more singles that didn't perform as well as anyone would have hoped. And in both cases, their tracks, I think, are really fantastic, including one featuring this guy.
Hi, I'm Paul Varney, and I'm talking to Chartbeats about my journey with Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Can't wait to get to that one. Let us know what you thought of this episode on Twitter, Threads, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for Chartbeats, and you can also contact me directly by searching for my name on Twitter and Threads. And please drop us a review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. In the meantime, be sure to check out this episode's bonus material.
Yes, we've got the full interview with Romy and Jazz, including what they thought of their image, all those hoodies and baseball caps, more on the recording of Reach Out and One Love, One World, and more detail about their time before and after the Romy and Jazz years. Head to chartbeats.com.au/saw, where you can subscribe to listen to the bonus material. Thank you once again for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks for our next episode. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.